I think we all know what it's like to make a mistake, to get into trouble. And sometimes we can wonder, when we're in a mess that we've made, whether God is still with us. We can often wonder, even if it's not a mistake of our own making, whether God is with us in our trouble. We can wonder, where is God now? Quite often people ask the sort of question, where was God when, when a disaster happened, when they were in trouble. Sort of we can have an idea of God being with us or not with us and worrying if he's left us. And even, as I said, non-Christians, those who do not believe in God, sort of have some idea of wondering where God is. The other question we can have with that is, where is God acting today? How does God act when it doesn't seem that we can see him at work? These are the sort of questions that were perhaps going through David's mind during this time on the run from Absalom. Psalm 3 starts, a psalm of David when he fled from his son Absalom. Lord, how many are my foes? How many rise up against me? Many are saying of me, God will not deliver him. David's wondering where God is, or there's those people around him saying, where is God? His God will not help him. As Johnny talked about a couple of weeks ago, the image of an avalanche going out of control, as David, the consequences of David's sin come into effect, from the adultery through to then in his family rape, murder, and now rebellion, as Absalom rebels against the king, trying to take his throne. David is on the run again. He has some loyal followers in Jerusalem to help him out, Hushai, Abiathar, and Zadok. But we've just read last week that Absalom had followed Ahithophel's advice to sleep with David's concubines, as Nathan had prophesied in chapter 12. As Absalom commits to be completely against David, showing that he wants David dead. He's the new king. He's now asking his advisers about how he should go after David. And we'll see in these passages how God continues to act in Israel's history and how he carries out what he said he'd do. And then there's also still the question hanging over this of who will be the next king. Has God left David? Is it going to be Absalom? Or will God be faithful to his promises and bring David back to the throne? Hopefully you have the outline with you. There's a map on the back, which we'll get to in time. That'll hopefully help sort of where a couple of people come from and where they're going. And you'll see that it's a long passage, a long two chapters. And through this, we're going to see how God carries out his plan through his faithful people. And therefore, these are people that act courageously, and we can act courageously when we understand God's plan and his faithfulness to us. There are sort of three headings, I think, got under that. God's at work, God uses people, and God keeps his promises, protects, and provides. Those aren't quite linearly through. You'll see that God's at work through the whole passage. God uses his people through the whole passage. And at different stages, we'll see how God keeps his promises, how God protects, and God provides. And then finally, in chapter 18, we'll look at God delivering his people through bringing disaster on their enemies, and that being good news for those on God's side. So, Absalom has just followed Ahithophel's advice to sleep with David's concubines. He's declared war on David. And now Ahithophel's top advisor, as we saw in the verse just before chapter 17 in 23, his advice was like one who inquires of God. This is the top advisor in the realm. Ahithophel's advice is highly regarded. It's good advice that he gives. So what is the advice that he gives when Absalom asks what to do next? I won't read it all out, but what he's saying is, attack quickly, go tonight. Attack while they're weary, while they're weak. David and his fighting men have their families with them. They've just had to flee Jerusalem. They've been going, traveling in a hurry. They're unprepared. This is a prime opportunity to strike quickly and kill David. Absalom only needs to kill David. Once David's dead, the people who've supported him will have to submit to Absalom as king. This is about a quick strike on David before he has a chance to prepare. And it avoids a big battle that would end up with many casualties. And as this is a civil war, neither side is looking for heavy casualties. The king wants some people to rule at the end of the war. Absalom and those with him like Ahithophel's advice. That's what it says in verse 4. This plan seemed good to Absalom and to all the elders of Israel. So why does Absalom ask Hushai for his opinion? He didn't ask Hushai at the end of chapter 16, Hushai was there. He'd just presented himself to Absalom and been accepted as an advisor. But Absalom follows Ahithophel's advice without asking for a second opinion. This is because at the end of chapter 16, Ahithophel unwittingly advised what would fulfill God's word through Nathan the prophet from back in chapter 12 when judgment was declared on David for his adultery. That someone from David's family would sleep with his wives in broad daylight. But now in chapter 17, Ahithophel's advice puts David under threat. Absalom says, "Summon also Hushai the Archite, so that we can hear what he has to say as well." When Hushai comes to him, Absalom says, "Ahithophel has given this advice. Should we do what he says? If not, give us your opinion." Here we see the start of God frustrating the advice of Ahithophel through Hushai. So Hushai has a chance to have his say. Remember, he'd been sent back to Jerusalem by David to frustrate Ahithophel's advice. This is his chance. And it's also what David prayed that God would do through Hushai. Hushai replies to Absalom, "The advice Ahithophel has given is not good this time." That's a brave thing to say, given Ahithophel's reputation and that everyone likes his plan. But Hushai puts forward a counter-argument, and there's a lot of ways in which Hushai is convincing. He appeals to Absalom's knowledge of David and implies that Ahithophel doesn't understand what David will be doing. Hushai uses imagery and that sort of language very effectively. I'll read through what he says in a moment and look out for that. He also plants doubt about the risk of Ahithophel's plan, saying if you should attack your troops first, they will melt with fear. I'll just read through Hushai says and spot some of those things. Hushai replied to Absalom, "The advice Ahithophel has given is not good this time. You know your father and his men. They are fighters and as fierce as a wild bear robbed of her cubs. Besides, your father is an experienced fighter. He will not spend the night with the troops. Even now he is hidden in a cave or some other place. If he should attack your troops first, whoever hears about it will say, 'There has been a slaughter among the troops who follow Absalom.' Then even the bravest soldier, whose heart is like the heart of a lion, will melt with fear, for all Israel knows that your father is a fighter and that those with him are brave." Hushai then puts forward his advice and appeals to Absalom's pride. "So I advise you, let all Israel, from Dan to Beersheba, as numerous as the sands on the seashore, be gathered to you, with you yourself leading them into battle. Then we will attack him wherever he may be found, and we will fall on him as dew settles on the ground. Neither he nor any of his men will be left alive. If he withdraws into a city, then all Israel will bring ropes to that city, and we will drag it down to the valley until not so much as a pebble is left." Imagine the grandeur and power that Absalom would feel. All Israel, from Dan to Beersheba, as numerous as the sand on the seashore, gathered to him leading them into battle, to this mighty, convincing victory, destroying David wherever he will be found. We see the response to Hushai's advice in 17 verse 14. Absalom and all the men of Israel said, "The advice of Hushai the Archite is better than that of Ahithophel." Absalom's conclusion is that Hushai's advice is better. Hushai has managed to do what he was sent back to do. He stopped Ahithophel's advice. But why did he succeed? Is it because Hushai is more convincing? Was it his appeal to Absalom's pride? Is it because of his excellent use of imagery, his rhetoric? The second half of verse 14 tells us why he succeeded. "For the Lord had determined to frustrate the good advice of Ahithophel in order to bring disaster on Absalom." And here in this verse, we have the key to the whole passage. Everything in these two chapters is about God bringing disaster on Absalom. God is putting his chosen King David back on the throne and is bringing down the man who is opposing him. As we go through the rest of this story this evening, the messengers and the battle and all that's to come, remember this insight that the writer gives us here. God is acting to bring disaster on Absalom. It's all in God's hands. Ahithophel's advice in chapter 16 was fulfilling what God had said through Nathan earlier on. Then when Ahithophel gives advice that puts David in danger, God guides Absalom to ask Hushai for his opinion. Through Hushai's compelling argument and through David's prayer for God to frustrate his advice, God frustrates Ahithophel's advice. This is all in order to carry out God's purposes. So God has a plan, and he's at work. God's made promises to David, and he will carry them out. In verse 15, we leave Absalom's council chamber, and we get quite a bit of excitement as the message about the advice is taken to David. Let's walk through this scene and get it clear in our minds what's going on, and then we'll go through it and see what there is for us to learn. Firstly, this communication network was planned by David back in chapter 15 as he left Jerusalem. David was going to wait before crossing the Jordan River until he received news from Jerusalem. He makes the plan back in chapter 15, verse 28. The plan was that Zadok and Abiathar, who were priests serving with the Ark of the Covenant, were in Jerusalem. Hushai was to give them a message. Both Zadok and Abiathar had sons, Jonathan and Ahimaaz. This is completely different Jonathan to David's best friend, Jonathan, who died a while back. The two sons, Jonathan and Ahimaaz, were staying in a town just outside Jerusalem called En-Rogel, which if you look on the map on the back, you should see that just next to Jerusalem. So they're just outside the city. Their fathers are inside the city. Hushai gives a message to the priests. The priests give the message to their sons. The sons run and take the message to David. It was okay for the priests to be in Jerusalem with the Ark of the Covenant and the Tabernacle, but it would have been too suspicious for Jonathan and Ahimaaz to come into Jerusalem. Hence, the servant girl who takes the message to them in En-Rogel. However, despite their precautions, a young man spots them and tells Absalom, Jonathan and Ahimaaz are now in danger. They go to a nearby town called Baharim, which you can also see on your map there, not far north of Jerusalem. And here they find a man and his wife who are loyal to David, and so help the two messengers. If you remember hearing of Baharim before, it's the town that David was approaching when Shimei cursed him as he left Jerusalem. This man and his wife hide the two messengers down a well, cover it over with grain, and tell the soldiers that the men had crossed over the stream and gone away. Once the soldiers have gone, Jonathan and Ahimaaz pop out of the well and run off to tell David the message. This is quite a bit of excitement for them. How close they were to being caught. You might be wondering why in those verses Hushai includes both his advice and Ahithophel's advice in the message. And why is the emphasis on David acting across in verse 21 and 22, why is that so much emphasis on Ahithophel's advice? We've just read back in verse 14 that the Lord had frustrated Ahithophel's advice and that Absalom and the men with him like Hushai's advice. So wasn't it settled? Well, there's a couple of reasons why I think this is the case. Firstly, there were concurrent events going on. There's things happening at the same time. If this was on camera, we'd have it on split screens, being able to watch the events going on in different places. However, in a book, you have to write them in order one at a time. We have a written account here, and Hushai needed to get the message out quickly, and I think it's possible he didn't know Absalom's decision at the time of sending the message. The other factor is that although Hushai, being a man of faith, he doesn't have the insight that we have in verse 14. We know that God's hand is in this, but Hushai doesn't know that in the way that we do. He was preparing for the possibility of Ahithophel's advice being followed, and perhaps Absalom changing his mind. After all, everyone knows that Ahithophel's advice is good advice, and even verse 14 admits that. Perhaps Absalom would change his mind. Either way, the important thing is that by God's protection and the courageous action of those faithful to David and to God, the message reaches David and David acts. In verse 22, we read that David and all the people with him set out and crossed the Jordan. By daybreak, no one was left who had not crossed the Jordan. David got them all to cross the river, and now they're safe from Ahithophel's plan. God has truly frustrated his advice. We saw in verse 14 that God's at work. And how is he at work? He's at work through his people. He is at work through the advice of Hushai, and now through all these different people that are involved in taking the message to David. They couldn't have done it without the unnamed couple who hide them in the well, or even the servant girl who was that first part of the message relay. God uses people to carry out his plans. He uses those loyal to him, those who don't join forces with the one who opposes God's plans. He uses those who are prepared to commit to supporting God's king, taking a side and risking their lives for God's plan. These people were taking a risk. Imagine if the soldiers in the well, if the soldiers had looked in the well and found Jonathan and Ahimaaz, or if they'd come back to the man and his wife after they couldn't find the messengers and discovered that they'd lied. It wouldn't have gone well for the couple, but they trusted God and acted courageously. And it's not just the named people of Hushai and Ahimaaz that have a part in God's plan. It's the servant girl playing a crucial role, this man and his wife being bold. And remember, in all of this, verse 14, God's in control. This is all in God's hands. And his sovereignty isn't just over Absalom and the royal advisers of those in the palace. God's sovereignty, his power and control, is also in the lives of normal, everyday people. He's not just interested in the so-called influential and significant people of the world, the people who are on the news each day. He's interested in the lives of you and me. And though history may not remember our names, God is interested in all his people and protects all who put their trust in him. We move on now to Ahithophel's death in verse 23. With David on the other side of the Jordan and the opportunity for a quick strike against David gone, we are back with Ahithophel. His advice hasn't been followed, and so he goes to his hometown, puts his house in order, and then hangs himself. I don't think he killed himself because of the hit to his pride and not being listened to. The commentaries on this passage are pretty much unanimous in that Ahithophel would have seen that with the opportunity to strike David quickly gone, and David now on the other side of the Jordan, things weren't looking good for Absalom. And when Absalom lost, Ahithophel wouldn't be around long anyway. With Absalom heading for disaster, Ahithophel was doomed with him. He's a man who had a certain level of wisdom. He was a top advisor. He put his house in order before he died, and he tried to escape the consequences of siding with Absalom. But he wasn't wise enough to support God's appointed king. Ahithophel's downfall is described in a matter-of-fact way. We're not to revel in it, we're not to look at it, at just the human level of him being against David. We're to see that he was against God, against God's appointed king. He is a warning to us and a warning to all those who stand in opposition to Jesus. There are consequences. Ahithophel's suicide, interestingly the second of four suicides in the Bible, and he does it to try and evade consequences, but in reality it brings him face to face with God quicker, and judgment by God is unavoidable. So there's disaster on Ahithophel here, but as we've seen, God protects those who are loyal to him. He protects those who are faithful to him, but there is no hope for those who are against God. Whose side you're on matters. Either you're on God's side or you're not. One day Jesus will be the unopposed king, but we are to be loyal to him and serve Christ's cause against those who oppose him now, even if it's risky for us. What does that look like for us? It means living as Jesus wants us to live, even when others are doing the opposite. Doing that at home, at work, with friends, in the public sphere, in what we post on social media, in what we comment in conversations. We need to stand up for what's right and true and support other believers who do. We serve Christ, not those around us. We need to act courageously and trust God's promises to protect. Now, a quick comment on this protection as well. As you all know, there are loads of believers and Christians in the Bible and throughout history who die. It's in God's hands, and that's what happens. It's encouraging to remember Paul's hope as he faced death at the end of 2 Timothy, where he writes that he trusts God to keep him safe, to take him to heaven safely, protecting him against all evil attacks. God protecting us doesn't mean we're invincible forever, but it does mean that when we're carrying out God's plans, he will protect us. And it gives us the comfort that when we do eventually die, when we are captured, when those kind of things happen, actually it's all in God's hands. He's in control. We next see from verse 24 onwards the provision of God for David. In verse 24 to 26 we have the movements of both armies. You can again look at the map on the back of the sheet. having sort of seen the messengers have gone up from Barim to David, they've now crossed the Jordan River and gone up to Mahanaim on the River Jabbok, and Absalom, and has now assembled his troops and is up there north of the River Jabbok, having got his army together. David's headed east from the Jordan, and we come back to him in verse 27. Meanwhile, Absalom's assembled more troops, as I said, as Hushai advised. He's got the army, he's crossed the Jordan River. Now, the commanders of Israel's army were Joab and Abishai, but they are now with David. Absalom now appoints Amasa as commander in place of Joab. The information about his descent tells us that Amasa is a cousin of Joab and Abishai and a nephew of David. This is a civil war with family on both sides, and David's family is being torn apart and are fighting against each other. Amasa comes up later on in chapter 20 and an encounter with Joab where only one of them walks away alive. But that's for later on. Absalom and his men are camped in Gilead with David in the nearby city of Mahanaim. And it's in this city that God provides for David. It's a provision that's not miraculous like manna from heaven, but is through people. Yet again, God is working through people. There aren't any outstanding miracles in this passage. There aren't any sort of awesome wonders, but there are God working through people. Mahanaim is a walled city. It's defendable. So now David is in a good position. And he is also well supplied, as we see in verse 27 to 29 of chapter 17. In these verses, first we see who it is that's provided for him, what they brought, and then thirdly, why they brought it. So who are these three people who helped David? They come from the area around Mahanaim, as shown on the map. You can see Lodabar up to the north, Rogalim just below it, and then Raboth just to the south of Mahanaim as well. These are people that are close enough to help David and come willingly and give generously. Shobi, son of an Ammonite. Nahash, the Ammonite king of 2 Samuel 10, perhaps. And we also have Machir, the man who Mephibosheth lived with when he came to live, before he came to live with David. This is the man who was a friend of the family of Saul. And finally, Barzillai. There's more on him later in chapter 19. We find out he's a wealthy man who supported David. And he's mentioned several times after his death. He's known as the Gileadite because one of his sons-in-laws was also called by the same name. And this is to distinguish this Barzillai the Gileadite, a well-respected man, it turns out. So we have an Ammonite, a man who was good friends with the family of Saul, and Barzillai, a well-respected Gileadite. Three people, but are all willingly coming to serve God. From different backgrounds, perhaps wouldn't expect them all to come together in support of David. But they have faith in God. They see David as God's appointed king. And they all side with David. So what do they bring? They bring a lot. It's not just the basics. Sure, they need wheat, flour and beans. But these men provide in abundance. Bedding, bowls and pottery. Wheat and barley. Flour and roasted grain. Beans and lentils. Honey and curds. Sheep and cheese. They've got bedding, pottery to put their honey and cheese in. It's not bad for a group on the run. And remember again, all through this passage, God is acting through people. God is going to restate David and will bring disaster to Absalom. Here David and those with him are provided for, and God is at work behind the scenes to make it so. Just as Absalom's heart was in God's hands when Absalom asked Hushai for advice, so God's hand is at work in the generosity of these three men. And isn't God gracious to provide? He promises he will provide what we need. And so often he gives us much, much more than we need. He gives us much better than basic rations. I think I can say that all of us here have more than we need. We might want even more still. But all of us can say that what we have out of God's kindness to us. And when we think about what's in our cupboards, what's the food in our fridges, the possessions in our homes, the technology in our pockets, and of course, the food we had at Emmanuel lunch this afternoon, we can thank God for his wonderful provision of far more than we need. Let's enjoy it, but let's not forget God. So that's who brought the provisions and what they brought, but why did they bring it? We get that at the end of verse 27. They brought it because the people had become exhausted and hungry and thirsty in the wilderness. These are people in great need, and these men are willing to help. What blessing in a time of need for David and those with him. But this isn't just helping someone in need. This isn't giving some money to someone on the street or helping someone going through a hard time. Absalom had sent messengers all over the kingdom proclaiming himself as king. All of these three guys and the families that they were with knew what was going on. They knew the conflict between Absalom and David. They knew what was at stake. And if they'd heard about David coming to Mahanaim and that those with him were in this state, hungry, exhausted and tired, they definitely know that David is on the run, and that's why he needs help. These are wealthy men. The risk-free option in this situation would be to sit back, let the fight happen, see who wins, and then go with the winner. Wait for a clear winner rather than risk siding with the loser. But these men side with David. They trust God's promises. They trust God's promises to David. They trust God's promises about the nation. And they are faithful to God in supporting the king that God has appointed. Those loyal to David are taking a risk and helping him. They're not waiting for the battle to be over so they can join the winner. They're on the side of God's anointed king, willing to serve God and the king. And God uses them in his plans for the kingdom. These are more people who courageously act, taking a side, siding with David, and risking their lives on their faith in God. Again, what about us? We can provide for others who work for God's kingdom. We can give generously. We're on the same side as everyone on this earth who is working for King Jesus, who is working to build God's kingdom. So let's not be afraid to support those who are in trouble. Let's not be afraid to support people like the Ashers in the Ashers baking case, those who are facing persecution across the world. Let's not be afraid to stand up for other brothers and sisters in Christ. Perhaps it's not just further afield, perhaps it's Christians getting a hard time at work or among your friendship groups, or someone saying something bad about someone you know, someone who is trying to further the gospel. Let's take the courage to stand up and show which side we're on. That's a word of kind of discernment. Of course, some Christians do bad things, and this isn't an excuse to defend everyone, every Christian, for anything that they do. We need to be discerning and not join causes that dishonor Christ. But let's not be passive out of fear, which I think is the bigger danger. God cares for us, and it's in his control. He keeps his promises, he protects his people and his plans, and he abundantly provides for all who trust in him. So that's our first section. As we've seen, God is at work, God has a plan. That's clear in verse 14. All of this is about God's plan, and it's a plan he's carrying out through his faithful people. So let's be courageous. Let's stand up. Let's show which side we're on. The next section, as we look at chapter 18, we're going to look at God delivering his people through bringing disaster on their enemies, and how this is good news for those who are on God's side. And keep in mind that chapter 17, verse 14, still holds sway over this chapter. God's plan is to bring disaster on Absalom and to vindicate David, to put David firmly back on the throne after his time of discipline, and to destroy those who oppose him. As the men prepare for battle, David appoints commanders over sections of his troops. David also tells them, "I myself will surely march out with you." However, the men protest. It's David that Absalom wants. If David dies, then they lose. It's better for him to stay in the city. This isn't like back in chapter 11 when he didn't go out to war and ended up committing adultery with Bathsheba. In this situation, I think it's good that he stays behind. And David agrees to stay behind so that he's safe. Remember Ahithophel's plan at the start of chapter 17. They just need to kill the king. It's like in chess. I don't know how many of you play chess, but in chess it's the king that's the most important piece. Because the king determines whether you win or lose. It doesn't matter if every other piece is still on the board. If your king's in checkmate, you lose. If you lose the king, you've lost the battle. So David gives then gives a command. He's not going to be on the battlefield, so he commands the three commanders to be careful about Absalom. Everyone hears the order to be gentle with the young man Absalom. This is a bit of a vague command. What does it mean to be gentle with him on the battlefield? And it shows David's priorities. His top priority is Absalom. The men, as we saw, value David because he is God's king. But David values Absalom because he's his son. Indeed, the focus of this whole chapter is on Absalom. And we come back to David and his priorities at the end of the chapter when the battle is over. But first, into the battle. Verses 6 to 8 of chapter 18 gives us a summary of the battle. And it's a decisive victory for David. And we get a glimpse here that the forest plays a significant role, claiming more lives than the sword. In short, this summary tells us that God gives David victory. And that's the report from the messengers after the battle. The Lord God has vindicated you today by delivering you from the hands of all those who rose up against you. The focus of the detail is on Absalom. The writer wants us to know about Absalom. This is God's hand at work in everything. The section is about bringing disaster on Absalom. And that's the bigger point. That's the point that the writer's making here than the details of the rest of the battle. So, what happens? Absalom is riding along on his mule, as we acted out earlier with the children, and he comes across some of David's men in the forest. His mule goes under a tree, and Absalom gets caught in the branches. Whether caught by his thick hair or whether his neck gets stuck in some branches, Absalom is stuck in the tree, alive but helpless. One of David's men sees Absalom hanging there and reports back to Joab. Joab is shocked that the man didn't kill him himself. And Joab doesn't wait around in doing the job, in carrying it out himself, in killing Absalom. You might think of Joab as a bit bloodthirsty here, but let's notice that once Absalom is dead, he sounds the trumpet to end the battle. There's no point fighting anymore once Absalom is dead. Absalom is buried in a pit in the forest under a pile of rocks, and then most people go home. There's probably at least a couple of questions in your mind about those verses. Perhaps the small question of wondering why three javelins in the heart didn't seem to kill Absalom and why the bodyguards need to finish it off. It's not that Absalom's some kind of superhero with a really strong heart. I think it's that the word translated heart can mean the general chest area rather than specifically the organs. The bigger question you have is probably not about that, but rather the ethical question. Was the man right not to kill Absalom, or was Joab wrong to kill Absalom? And the fact that we have dialogue between them shows it's significant. And I think it is, in many ways, a difficult question to answer. And God didn't inspire the writer of this account to comment every few verses whether what the characters did was right and wrong. We're to think about it, and to think about it not by asking first and foremost about what the human characters are doing, but I think what God is doing. The number one question to ask is, what is God doing here? God is committed to his kingdom and against anything that is against his kingdom. Remember, Absalom is completely against David. He's not trying to reconcile with David. He slept with his concubines. He's trying to kill David. He's forcefully trying to take over and begin his rule, shaming his father. Absalom is an enemy of God. And also consider that Joab was just the finishing touch. Who is it that really did Absalom in? Who is it that put him in the tree? It was God. Did Joab disobey David? Yes, he did. Was what David commanded wise or even realistic? I think we can be not so sure about that. I don't think it was. Was Joab loyal to David? I think that Joab was loyal to David in getting rid of this issue. There was going to be no peace for David while Absalom was alive. The kingdom was under threat. And as I've said, I don't think that Joab is just bloodthirsty. He restrains the fight once Absalom is dead. And what that's one of the things about this passage, you remember there were some lies earlier on from those that hid the messengers. Joab isn't pure, but I don't think anyone in this narrative really is. And none of us are today. We all have wrong motives and are tainted with sin, but God is sovereign. There's no one who's completely innocent here. But it is God's plan going through it all. Absalom's death was out of David's control, but it wasn't out of God's control. This was the disaster God was bringing on Absalom. The situation is messy for us to decipher the rights and wrongs of the individual actions, but God acts through it. It's a mess. Life's a mess, but God is still sovereign. God does what he plans. Nothing can mess up his plans. And while it might be difficult for us to tell what is exactly right and wrong about these different things, we can trust that God will carry out his plan. And we don't need to worry. We can't mess his plan up. In verse 18, we get a quick word of Absalom's legacy. And it seems to me that there's a certain parallel between this comment about Absalom in 18 verse 18 and the one about Ahithophel back in verse 23. Both have short summaries after their death. And here we have two enemies of God's king, two enemies of God, both defeated, both dead, but God's king lives. All of God's enemies will be like this one day, dead, gone. Ahithophel was buried with his family, Absalom in a pit. To be honest, it doesn't matter much where you're buried, does it? It doesn't matter what happens to your body once you're dead. But I think there's a significant point we can learn about their legacy, about what they were working to leave behind after they were gone. Absalom was worried about the memory of his name. Would people remember him in the years to come? He set up a monument for himself in the King's Valley, naming it after himself. With no son, he wanted to make sure that his name went on. If you have an excellent memory, you may recall that actually back in chapter 15, Absalom had three sons and a daughter. And so if he had three sons, how come here he says he has no sons? And well, there are two possible explanations. The first is that the monument was set up before the sons were born. I think the most likely possibility is that actually the three sons that were born to him all died before he took over in his claim to be king. That would sort of match up with the fact that we don't get any names for his sons and how they recorded those things. And this monument is set up for his name to be preserved. Unlike the promise to David that his offspring will reign forever, Absalom has no descendants. Absalom has a pillar. Ahithophel put his house in order for his family, making sure things were in order for them before killing himself. What legacy are you building? An inheritance to leave behind? Are you seeking a monument, a statue with your name on it? Well, most of us will have a stone with our name on it, a stone with two dates. And I think it's interesting to think that one of those dates we already know. The other date that will be on our tombstone is as unknown to us as it is inevitable. Am I worried about my name being remembered? Or are we concerned about God's name being known? Are we living our lives for God, entrusting our work to him who sees everything and rewards those who serve him faithfully? How are we using the time that we have alive on earth? And does it reflect which side we're on? Because we're either on God's side or we're against God. And if we're on God's side, then how we live should look like we're on God's side. The legacy we're seeking to leave, should be one that's seeking to make God known, not ourselves known. So disaster falls on Absalom, and David is vindicated by being delivered from his enemies. What does vindication mean? To vindicate means to show or to prove to be right. It's to be reasonable or justified, to be cleared of blame or suspicion. Imagine someone put on trial, falsely accused. They go through months of legal procedures, of court cases, receive all sorts of horrible messages from people who think they're guilty. Then eventually the verdict comes through, not guilty. They're vindicated. Imagine their relief. They've been found right to be innocent. That's the image of vindication. And both in chapter 18, verse 19, and then in verse 31, the message that the messengers bring is that God has vindicated David by delivering him from his enemies. Vindication by deliverance. God has shown David to be the right king. He's guilty of doing a lot wrong in his life, but he is the true king. And here vindication and disaster go together. Judgment and disaster on the enemy is what shows David to be the one. Disaster on the enemies of God's people vindicates God's people. It shows God's people to be right. In verse 19, we're back on the battlefield, and there's a message of victory to be sent. It needs to be taken to David. And for the second time, we have two messengers. There's Ahimaaz and another man. Ahimaaz is keen to run. Joab says, no, you're not the one to take the message, because the king's son is dead. And we could go into the reasons of perhaps why Ahimaaz wants to run and why Joab doesn't send him. I won't do that now for time. But as it ends up, Ahimaaz insists on running anyway. And Ahimaaz goes a different route and outruns the Cushite, getting there first. We're then back with David in Mahanaim. Now remember, David and those with him don't know what's happened. They don't know how the battle's gone, and they don't know about Absalom. I'm sure you can remember a time when you're waiting for news that could go either way. Either excellent news or very bad news. Perhaps exam results, perhaps the results of some tests at the doctor's. David is waiting for the news of the battle. The first runner appears in the distance, getting closer. He's on his own. That's a good sign. Then another runner appears, also on his own. He must be bringing good news too, says David. It seems that they had a system for good and bad news. The first runner gets closer and closer, till the watchman can see. It's Ahimaaz. Good, David thinks. Then finally Ahimaaz is within shouting distance. All is well, he calls out. It's good news. Imagine the relief of those around David, as Ahimaaz says, praise be to the Lord your God. He delivered up those who lifted their hands against my lord the king. Yes, victory. But David isn't celebrating. As we saw before the battle with the command he gave about Absalom, David's main concern is whether his son is alive. Absalom is his priority. He asks, is the young man Absalom safe? Then I think it's quite a surprise that Ahimaaz lies. He seems to have understood God's hand in the victory and hasn't done anything wrong up until this point. But yet again, we're seeing it's a bit of a mess and no one seems to be quite perfect. For whatever reason, he says, oh, there's some confusion as I left and I don't really know what happened. It's not long to wait for the Cushite to arrive and bring the same news of victory. Good news. My lord the king, hear the good news. The Lord has vindicated you today by delivering you from the hand of all those who rose up against you. Again, David's concern is for Absalom. And this time the Cushite delivers the truth, albeit in a slightly cryptic way. The meaning is clear. Absalom is dead. David is shaken and weeps. Oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom. If only I had died instead of you. Oh, Absalom, my son, my son. It must be horrible to grieve the death of your son. He was a rebel who wanted to kill David, but still his son. And David is probably also mourning his responsibility for what's happened. His grief is complicated by the guilt. If he hadn't sinned all that time ago, perhaps Absalom would have turned out differently and not died like this. In chapter 19, we'll see Joab's rebuke of David, and I'll leave saying more about David's priorities and what was going on there for that. What we needed to know is that Absalom had set himself against God's anointed king, and so had set himself against God. And God had delivered David from those trying to kill him, and was keeping his promises to David, the promises about a kingdom. And here deliverance comes with disaster. It's the defeat of the enemy that brings victory and peace. The preserving of God's kingdom involved the destruction of its enemies. Absalom had set himself against God, and God brought disaster on him. And so it will be when Jesus returns. There will be disaster on those who oppose him. Satan and all who join against God will be destroyed. The power of sin and death will be defeated, and God's people will be delivered from sin, delivered from death, raised to life eternal. Those who were persecuted for their faith will be shown to be right, vindicated. Those who trusted in Jesus and courageously acted out of faith in him will be shown to be right, vindicated. And all who are part of God's kingdom will live forever, victorious. And so we see that for those on God's side, we can rejoice in the good news of God bringing disaster on his enemies. And God works through his people. Let's not miss that, and let's be courageous in how we act. We can risk our own pursuits, our own ambitions, to be faithful to God's kingdom, because God is in control, and he keeps his promises to his people. I just want to then finish by reading some of the rest of Psalm 3 that I quoted at the start. Psalm 3, when he was on the run from Absalom, David said, Lord, how many are my foes? How many rise up against me? Many are saying of me, God will not deliver him. But you, Lord, are a shield around me. my glory, the one who lifts my head high. I called out to the Lord, and he answers me from his holy mountain. I lie down and sleep. I wake again because the Lord sustains me. I will not fear, though tens of thousands assail me on every side. Arise, Lord, deliver me, my God. Strike all my enemies on the jaw. Break the teeth of the wicked. From the Lord comes deliverance. May your blessing be on your people.